Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel Performance Maximizer, Google drops tablets, Apple's MacBook Pro recall, PCI Express 6.0, and new tariffs could mean big jumps in laptop prices. All that more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 522, recorded on June 20th, 2019. Intel Performance Maximizer MacBook Pro recall and some massive price hikes are coming. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that brings you hardware news, and we are chock full of it today, from lithium-ion battery-related recalls to concerns about tariffs to, much more importantly, performance maximization and PCI Express 6.0, because, hey, didn't we just get PCI Express 4.0? Joining me, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton, by the way. You may know me from AVXL and various other places. I am joined, as always, by PC Purs, editor-in-chief and benchmarking stud, Sebastian
Benchmarker-in-chief.
Benchmarker-in-chief.
Hello.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm in the middle of it, as you can see, because a certain company with a three-letter acronym is releasing processors soon, and I don't have them. And if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you that, but I'm just getting ready. I've got last-generation stuff on the test benches and redoing all the benchmarks because, of course, if you follow Windows news, Windows 10 1903 is the latest build of Windows, and it contains, you know, enhancements to the way that the Ryzen scheduler works and, mitigations and running latest versions of BIOS on things. So basically, all the lovely things that have happened in the last few months have made it so that everybody who was sitting on like 10-month-old benchmarks for CPUs pretty much has to do all that work all over again.
Yeah, I've literally, it just queued up for me, and I've been waiting to do a couple of things until I was actually literally like just in the last couple of days is Windows 1903 is queued and ready for download and installation. So I'm going to avoid hitting that download button until after the podcast, just in case.
Yes, please.
Something else we've avoided. There's this wonderful graphic on the front page, not front page, on the article on AVS forum, but I got an email from Emotiva, who is a US-based audio supplier. They build a little bit of their stuff in the United States. All of their stuff is designed and engineered in the United States. Most of it's built in China, and we've had some tariffs. You may have heard there is a trade war with China. A lot of the products we talk about have been excluded from that. For example, lots and lots of cell phones, at least in the first rounds. And the first rounds were relatively modest tariff hikes. Now we're looking at a 25% hike hitting at the beginning of July, I want to say. And what a magnificent Chinese flag wipe that was. Props to Kevin. But they sent out an email and a blog entry basically saying that we can't absorb this. I like what the CEO says. Our internal markup is about half the industry average. Therefore, we don't have the extra wiggle room for cost increases in our prices. And as you may have already know, we've just had another tariff increase of 25% on imported Chinese-made goods. When the first round of tariff increases happened a few months back, we absorbed the increased cost without raising prices as part of our commitment to you, the customer. However, this most recent change in policy has caused another significant increase, and we will have to raise our prices starting on July 1st, 2019. They said it'll be minimal. I'll be kind of, kind of looking at the before and afters when they show up. But this is one of the few companies that was kind of getting out ahead of this. Now, Dan Laufman, the CEO, some people think he's a bit of a showboat. Some people don't like him. Some people love him. I think he makes some great products at some great prices. They do a direct sale model, so it behooves him to talk directly to his incredibly loyal customer base. I mean, they actually have like an annual gathering in Tennessee at the headquarters where Emotiva customers can go hang out with other Emotiva customers and you know, meet the staff and try new stuff. So obviously he has a very tight relationship with his user base. But this is going to be I'm curious to think if this is a canary in a coal mine for what happens with a lot of consumer electronics coming July of this year. They're basically saying they're only going to have like a 5% increase, right? Because the cost, or the tariffs are only hitting on the cost of the stuff coming from China. And there's, like they said, there's wiggle room in there. But I'm super curious to see where this ends up. Now, in their case, loudspeakers and subwoofers aren't going to be impacted by the tariff. Some of their surround sound processors and upgrade programs will not be impacted by the price increases. But I'm very curious to see how this impacts the cost of goods from various and sundry manufacturers. And, you know, it's not just little tiny audio companies that you may or may not have ever heard of. PC World, I think you found this article on PC World. Mark Hockman wrote up, senior editor, PC World. Quote, Trump tariffs on Chinese goods could cost you $120 more for notebook PCs, says Dell, HP, and the CTA.
Yeah.
So the CTA, if you're not familiar, is Consumer Technology Association, and they did a public comment to the proposed action that was filed on Wednesday. They are not super thrilled about this. You know, whenever Dell and HP get together to comment on something, it's usually a sign of how upset they are or how excited they are. The letter itself is what I will affectionately call a bit of a dry read. Joseph Barlum, General Counsel, Office of the U.S. Trade Representatives, blah, 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 blah. Dear Mr. Barlum, basically it comes down to the proposed tariffs on laptop computers and tablet devices, here and after laptops, threaten to disproportionately harm multiple U.S. interests, including small and medium-sized businesses, a wide range of consumers, and device manufacturers. At the same time, the imposition of tariffs on such products would not address the underlying Chinese trade practices that the USTR's investigation seeks to remedy. Instead, the tariffs will harm U.S. technology leaders, hindering their ability to innovate and compete in a global marketplace. Accordingly, we respectfully request that the USTR remove laptops classified under HTSUS subheading 8471.30.01 from the final tariff list, which is basically saying, like, we get what you're trying to do, but you're going to hurt our customers and you're going to hurt our ability to compete globally. So why don't you just pull us off the list? It's fairly readable for what amounts to a legal document. A couple of standout lines. U.S. laptop manufacturers currently rely on Chinese suppliers to satisfy U.S. demand for laptop products. Transitioning to alternative supply sources is not feasible in the near term. And here's the big one. A recent study commissioned by the Consumer Technology Association estimates that U.S. prices for laptops and tablets will rise by at least 19%, i.e. around $120 for the average retail price of a laptop if proposed tariffs are implemented. These price increases will hit during peak holiday and back-to-school demand season and will directly affect ordinary consumers such as families, students, school systems, and the U.S. government. So, and it goes on and on and on and on. I mean, how are you feeling about this?
Not great. I saw that Apple has their own little letter of protest here, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're the one company that won't raise prices necessarily, but may have to eat profits. But I mean, 2/3 of their business is the iPhone, and that's what they're mainly concerned about, because we're talking up to 25% on different product categories. So that's going to hurt them a lot. And I've heard about scrambling to move production to Taiwan from a lot of these places.
Right.
That's, you can't get up and running in just a few months to escape this. These companies are going to take a huge write-off if they're going to lose that much profit. Or we're just going to see prices go up, which is bad for consumers. So it's not good news for anybody, because, you know, the truth of the matter is we are into technology. Most technology in the world is made in China, and most of these companies outsource to China. You mentioned Emotiva. A lot of companies have their, at least their lower end loudspeaker and high end component lines made in China. It's going to affect a lot of different enthusiasts out there. I know it's already affected the bicycle industry. I'm into bikes. Most of the frames that you buy are made in China, and they're going to have to start outsourcing. Like, I know Giant, I think, is starting to move their productions to Taiwan as well, just to escape this. So it's definitely impacting a lot of companies and a lot of big industries in a very big way. And who knows when it's all going to stop.
It's probably not going to stop anytime soon. I don't know. Not. it's not July 1st yet. It'll be interesting to see what ends up being excluded from the list and what's included. We will know more in a couple of weeks. So, more cheerful news. Intel releases the Performance Maximizer one-click overclocking for select Gen 9 CPUs. How'd Jim feel about this one?
The really short version is that it's extremely easy to use. It's effortless, really, if you own one of the very few processors that you can currently enable this with. It's ninth generation stuff, so the i9-9900, KF and right. K, 9700 KF and K, and the i5-9600K and KF. The F versions are the ones without graphics because, you know, F stands for without graphics, of course. but it's a free tool, and if you have one of these processors already, it's just a really solid way of overclocking just your processor. This is not like the sort of whole system overclocking, like one-touch OC things we've seen from motherboard vendors where they do a memory overclock as well as a CPU overclock. But what Jim had kind of pointed out about this was, in his experience, those tend to be a little aggressive with raising your CPU voltage. They're a little lazy about it. Like, it raises the CPU voltage a lot to give you a high overclock result, but would you really want to live at 1.38, 1.4 volts on your CPU all the time? And mm-hmm. the Intel tool he found was much closer to stock voltage and very good overclocks. And in fact, he was getting 4.8 or 4.9 gigahertz on all cores on an i9-9900K. Yeah, 4.9 is what he ended up with. And this is just an automated test. You run it. It's very much like NVIDIA's OC scanner. It runs for a long time. Like, just leave the room, come back an hour later. It's come up with your overclock, and it does it a minimal amount of voltage adjustment. And then Intel has sort of brought back, I guess it never really went away, but there was this overclocking insurance plan they used to sell. When I bought my, right. I think it was my 2600K, you could buy one of these policies for $25. They're $19.99 now, and they say that they'll replace the processor one time if you damage it overclocking. So it's the performance tuning protection plan. So it's if you're willing to spend another $20 on top of your processor, and what's $20 when you're already spending like $300 or $400 or $500 on one of these CPUs, then it's the peace of mind of, oh, I'll just let this thing run 24/7 at 4.9 or 5 gigahertz. And if anything goes wrong, $20, they'll give me a new CPU. So it's interesting, and it's free, which is nice. So if you were looking at one of these CPUs, if you're not on the Ryzen bandwagon, or if you already have one of these, free performance. And the thing I love the most about it, just to reiterate again, minimal voltage increases, which is great. Now, you still have to do manual memory overclocking. And Jim did notice one thing with the board he was using, which was it didn't like his XMP profile for memory, which is that easy one-click memory profile that comes on like virtually every stick of aftermarket DDR4 RAM. Right. It's, you know, it's Intel's own spec, but for whatever reason, XMP wasn't working with this particular time. But he went and re-enabled it after he got his overclock, and it was all fine. So minimal effort overclocking is always good.
It's, it's interesting to look at the performance gains between, you know, in some cases it's like a dead heat. In some cases there's a little advantage in manual overclocking. In some cases, especially in memory, there's a huge advantage in manual overclocking compared to the IPM. I mean, I think anything that makes overclocking easier is a positive. I also think at this point, we are not going to be seeing a lot of huge gains out of these processors.
Turbo
compared
boost
to the factory performance.
Yeah. Think about the old days, and you had a fixed speed. You bought a 700 megahertz processor. That's all it was, unless you turned it up. And there was no variable frequency other than like power savings. At some point in history, processors were clocking down to save power at idle, but not the other way. They weren't clocking up when you were under load, and they weren't doing it per core. So these per core turbos, and the fact that these processors can hit 5 gigahertz on up to 2 cores, And then, like, you know, they scaled down to, I think, like 4.6 or 4.7 for that i9-9900K part. You're getting free performance as you go anyway. So all you're really doing is tweaking the per core overclocks on these things, which you could already do with your motherboards. A lot of motherboards already have a multi-core enhancement enabled by default. So it'll have all the cores boosted, whatever the top frequency is. So, you know, it's like you said, it's at this point, you're not seeing huge gains because the processors are already sort of intelligently overclocking as you use them.
Right. I'm curious to say, I think we beat this horse to death last week, but we're both really, really curious to see the Ryzen 3000 processors, the performance and benchmarking them against the Intel processors, and the overclockability of those new Ryzen processors. Curious we are. Also curious, I'm going to...
You've got a note here.
You know, it feels like it was just May 29 of this year when they announced PCI Express 5.0. And you note that because PCI Express 6.0 was just announced. Why? What is the point?
Well, they have a beautiful infographic that explains why I/O bandwidth apparently needs to double every 3 years. The funny part is they have announced a new spec 3 weeks after the last one. And, you know, AMD, very proud of PCI Express 4.0 coming on their new Ryzen processors if you get one of the new X570 boards. But Intel, I had heard, was going to sort of leapfrog them and go right to PCI Express 5.0. And that spec was announced and ready to go. And it's coming soon. And now, 3 weeks later, here we have PCI Express 6.0. At this point, wouldn't it be worth it just to wait 3 more weeks and get PCI Express 7.0? Because every time these new specs are ratified, I don't know if this one's been ratified yet, it's been announced, it's double the bandwidth per pin. So who needs PCI Express 6.0? I mean, look at that chart. At some point in the future, we're going to get to like 256 gigabytes per second bandwidth per lane. You know, and
Oh, goodness. I mean, part of me is, this is like that moment in a financial call where, you know, these are forward, you know, basically where they say, like, this is all forward looking, which means it's in the future, which means I'm guessing, so don't sue me. But it's just, you know, part of me feels like renouncing 6.0 this early is a guaranteed way to make sure that they need to do like 6.0.1 inside of a year because everything scales up faster than they, I don't know. This seems silly to me.
It reeks of the USB IF. And we talked about that a few weeks ago where they were trying to convince everybody in one of these press releases that let's rebrand USB 3.1 to USB 3.2. And I'm thinking, where the heck is USB 4 in all of this? Why couldn't 3.2 Gen 2 by 2, which we will talk about in a moment, be just be called USB 4? Who wants to, like, no one's going to realize what that is on the box if they go to an office store or a Best Buy and they're looking at laptops. Is USB 3.2 Gen 2 by 2 going to mean anything? At this point, it looks like a wireless spec. And all these speeds that are thrown out there are all theoretical. And it's really, to me, my stance has been the spec should have been Type-C connector, minimum 10 gigabit per second or 20 gigabit per second speed, and that's USB 4.0. Basically Thunderbolt. Borrow from Thunderbolt. And it's maybe they were just waiting for Intel to open source Thunderbolt, which happened recently. And that can be USB 4.0. But multiple connectors, multiple speeds, multiple generations, two of which actually mean the same thing. So be careful.
Not that you're bitter about this.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, anything you go out and buy, even if I have the fastest NVMe drive I can buy, and I buy a nice NVMe adapter to connect it to my PC externally, the fastest connection I can use, it's still 10 gigabits per second, unless you're buying some sort of, you know, high-end solution that contains like dual Thunderbolts or something, or, you know, has some sort of bridge chip. And
so let's talk about what Phison's working on, right? Their interpretation of a USB 3.2 2x2 external SSD storage controller. You know, this whole series of slides, and I'm not trying to be cruel to Phison, but this is one of those moments where this is like a mid-1990s spec in the sense that, like, let's deal with a lot of obscure crap that shouldn't exist because people made poor decisions leading up to the announcement of a spec that's going to be a stopgap. You know, I don't want to sort of repeat your angsty moment there, but yeah,
it was angsty.
You know, so 1300 megabits per second or 1.3 gigabits per second, you know, which I like Anton Shylov's notes here, which is notably higher than USB SSDs featuring a lower bandwidth USB 3.2 Gen 2 interface. So retail USB drives are going to show up with this next year. 2 NAND channel, 16 CEs that support, quote, modern types of flash, including 3D TLC and 3D QLC NAND with Toggle 3.0 or UNFI 4.0 interfaces. And then Phison's fourth gen implementation of LDPC and RAID-based ECC goes on and on and on, which is cool, right? Because they actually do AES 256 on the controller.
Yeah.
200K and 13- IOPS.
1300 megabytes per second is good because if you look at, like, I recently got in a Lexar Pro external drive. Those are really nice, really fast, 10 gigabit per second speeds. They max out at about 900 megabytes per second writes, 950 megabytes per second reads. The external NVMe enclosure that I tested recently with a really fast drive still topped out right around those same numbers. I could get close to like 920, 930 writes, about 940, 950. Reads. So if a new controller comes out and you can connect it to your brand new laptop in, like, you know, at the end of this year, maybe early 2020, and it's getting speeds significantly over 1,000 megabytes a second, that's good. But I mean, to go from 950 to 1300 is not very exciting. It would be nice if the new spec came out and it was double the speed, which is how I kind of interpret 2x2. Like, oh, that's like two lanes. So simultaneous streams of Gen 2 USB 3.2, apparently not. Well, not with this controller anyway. So maybe a later controller or a different flash configuration could saturate, double the bandwidth.
Well, on Antec article, there's a great series of cranky comments, and then somebody steps in and it's like, this is a perfectly reasonable description of this, which I get. Which is part of why it reminds me of 1995, where it's like, this obscure acronym is incredibly intelligent and organized, much like the naming system of BMWs. But, you know, as he points out, Repoman 27, where did it go? The 3.2 release also describes channel bonding in the form of dual lane operation. Like every other IO specification in history, it also adopts a convention of indicating the number of lanes in a link with a lowercase x followed by the number of lanes. None of this is different from any other specification out there or involves branding, trademarks, or marketing in any way, nor is any of it particularly confusing if you've learned to count to two.
Wow.
So as an official, you know, grouchy old man, get off my lawn. One hand, I get where this guy's coming from. But on the other hand, most people aren't particularly aware of channel bonding or how it impacts things or the fact that they have a 2x2 or a 4x4, you know, router, or whether or not, you know, the implementation in their laptop can even take advantage of that. And, you know, to RepoMan 27's credit, I should point out that we were kind of irritated because one of the few things everybody understood to a degree, like 802.11b, 802.11g, 802.11n, 802.11ac, not particularly intuitive, but people got it. And then, you know, Wi-Fi decides to go like, yeah, we got it. But we want to sort of push you into the next generation of Wi-Fi. So we're going to call that Wi-Fi 6. Because Wi-Fi 6 is easier, and it's bigger than 5. So we know when you're buying a new router, you'll know to go for 6 instead of 5. And it feels like, you know, reducing everything to a Sesame Street commercial or Sesame Street segment. And it might not if they hadn't spent so many years, you know, giving us all of that inscrutable 802.11, you know, A, B, G, N, AC, AC 2x2, 4x4, and all the other stuff. So, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth. I just want to see this stuff ship so I can start moving video faster.
Yeah. You know, the pendulum swinging, not to steal your thunder, is an amazing transition to the next story on the list. About, you know,
Google,
all the momentum for tablets, and everybody had to have a tablet after March 2010, and maybe the laptop form factor is better.
Well, there's certain things that tablets are fantastic for consuming content. And the thing is most of the content you can consume on them is relatively low power. I mean, it's been interesting, right? Because I've got that, you know, $65 tablet and with 2 megabytes of memory, and I'd like more memory so I could run more than one app without sort of a distinct waiting period in between app A and app B. But the reality is this off-brand, you know, unnamed processor has more than enough power to do, you know, basic gaming, Netflix, Amazon Prime, pretty much most of the stuff I'm doing on there. It's got the crappiest camera on the planet, but I don't buy a $65 tablet to do photography. J.R. Raphael, contributing editor, Computer World, Google's officially done making its own tablets. The Pixel Slate won't get a number of sibling, and Google's future self-made computers will revolve exclusively around the laptop form. And, you know, I touched on this a little bit when we talked about that the On tablet from Walmart is, you know, the specs look really soft on that, right? 2 megabytes of RAM. And then I started realizing that Samsung was selling slightly svelter devices with screens that may be a little bit better. But, you know, if you're sort of, you know, half paying attention to Netflix while dealing with, you know, the mayhem of your, you know, your siblings or your children, you're probably not, you know, deeply invested in the experience. And if you're just sitting in the dark quietly enjoying something, you're probably able to overlook some of the, you know, color issues on an inexpensive screen. But A, the screen wasn't that bad. I didn't look at it and immediately vomit. And B, you know, tablets with similar specs from major consumer electronics manufacturers were in some cases more than two and a third as much. So, as JR points out, right? Google hasn't announced any tablet specific products this year. You know, the last one they announced was the Pixel Slate. But apparently, he learned that there were two small tablets under development, and they just decided to kill them off. I think partially because when you look at small tablets and large screen Pixel phones, man, that's, you know, a 7-inch tablet versus a 6-inch Pixel XL, that's a thin line. Mostly around one being a lot less expensive than the other one. So, you know, unannounced products won't be announced. And this also is, I think, part of he points out, this seems to be part of a larger effort on Google this year of scaling back on the in-house made hardware, which, given that they are competing with some of their, you know, the people they rely on to make their operating systems popular and to, you know, more importantly, keep their services on as many millions and millions and millions of devices as possible, I think is probably pretty sensible on Google's part. What happened with the whole idea of, okay, so a couple of years ago, a year ago, 2 years ago on AVXL, Robert and I were sitting down finalizing some scripts, and I just tore into him like, it's time. He's like, what? I'm like, it's time to just stop talking about the operating systems and televisions. In part because we were looking at really expensive televisions with, you know, semi-proprietary or in-house operating systems, and stuff wasn't being supported and it wasn't being updated. And it was just like, you know, you're spending $2,000 on a television, even if you're spending $750 on a television, unless it is a like a Roku-based TV, a Roku TV, just go out and buy a Roku box or an Apple TV box, depending on, you know, where your content lives. And this is this is horrible. You know, is this a security reminder or an actual bug that was showing up on Samsung's smart TVs?
Well, I think it was their service. It was their support Twitter account, I think. Yeah, Samsung Support USA.
Right.
That had tweeted out about, hey, it's a best practice to scan your TV for viruses and use our handy virus scanning app that's built into the TV. Apparently, if you go into the menus, you can find this thing. And apparently, PR caught wind of this and deleted it immediately. Not before, naturally, it was screenshotted. The Verge got the story, and it went all over the place for a couple of days. And I'm sure they're just waiting for this to blow over because they wouldn't like you to worry about your TV. But this brought up kind of a bigger conversation, which I think it was Neil at The Verge who talked to the head of Vizio a while back about smart TVs and why this is not something that's a feature of expensive television. Smart TVs are pervasive in the entire industry. Even the cheap TVs have it. Why? And it's really because they subsidize the cost of the TVs with it. It's like laptops with junkware. Every trial version of an app that comes on that commercial PC cuts a little bit off of the total build costs and increases the margins, which is vital for an industry like that with razor thin margins when they're being so price competitive. And TVs are the same way. It's a race to the bottom, it seems, with 4K TVs. So, well, we sell your data, and that's how we make our money. And that's why every TV, even down to a $300 or $400 TV, is going to have smart apps and be connected and have all these scary-looking warnings you have to agree to when you first power it on at home. So whether or not you allow them to use a microphone and a camera, they're still collecting data about everything that you watch through the smart apps, you know.
Right.
And that's worth money. And that apparently, according to Vizio anyway, it would require them to charge more for a TV without any smart features than to just give you the smart features. And I was looking at Vizio TVs a couple years ago before I bought the LG that I ended up with, because they had really attractive pricing on large, like 70-plus-inch TVs, which were essentially just monitors, some of which came with a tablet instead of a remote control and were literally just displays run by an Android tablet. But so many of these TVs now are running Android or that sort of operating system and rely on it. And the app ecosystem just kind of makes sense when you're already running a mobile operating system. And, you know, plenty of people just use the built-in apps on their TV and find it very convenient, too. I'm right. In the minority who would like a TV that's not connected to anything except wall power and my HDMI sources, and then I could literally walk a thumb drive over to it if I wanted to do a firmware upgrade, and that's it. But, you know, I'm in a very small minority, I'm sure.
No, you're not, but there's you know, the most television manufacturers can't be bothered. It's too expensive to spin up a separate line, and they have so many complicated, relationships in place where they just want to put the same, or maybe from an engineering perspective, it's just easier for them to put the same thing on every single system. It's frustrating. Almost as frustrating as yet another, as you know, we're looking at what promised to be some of the most powerful processors in the history of processors. These are consuming like 100 watts, 130 watts, stock. Although, again, we'll find out what they really consume when they're turned up in the near future. Yet another 1,000 watts power supply comes out. This one is from Silverstone. And this one's kind of crazy because it's an SFXL power supply.
Yeah.
Which is to say it's twee.
Yes. It's that slightly longer L is for long version of the SFX power supply, which is that really small mini ITX power supply standard. And Silverstone, I've visited with them a couple of times at CES, and they're all about power supply density. And they've come out with some really impressive stuff in the ultra-compact ATX form factor and with SFX. This is just crazy. 1,000 watts from a power supply that's basically the same footprint as a 120-millimeter fan.
Mm-hmm.
That's because SFX L just barely fits that full-size fan, which makes them very quiet, gives them better cooling, and enables them to do things like this. I would love to see the inside of this thing. Just, it's got to be so densely packed. And why you would necessarily need 1,000 watts when you're constrained in an enclosure that requires a power supply of this size, I'm not exactly sure, but I want to find out. I would love to see Silverstone or someone else build an enclosure that's ultra thin, right, that makes use of a smaller power supply like this, but still enables you to put whatever you want in it.
I mean, my issue at this point, when you're talking about power consumption, I can get the wattage into the power supply and the GPU, but I don't think I can find a, you know, sub 40 or 50 millimeter cooler that will fit inside of those constraints, which is, you know, it's interesting. It's also interesting to see where some of these SFX power supplies are showing up in terms of cases where, you know, by using one of these power supplies, they can create a little more internal space or just lower the dimensions of the rig slightly. But you know, now you will be able to fit your triple TIs and your overclock top of the line processor inside of one of these smaller cases. I'm really curious to see what the performance looks like and what the thermals are like.
Especially if that fan is nice and quiet, because that would be kind of defeat the purpose of the really unobtrusive small systems. I'm hoping, because it's a 120 millimeter fan, it wouldn't start screaming. That's the issue you run into with the non-L variant of SFX in the past anyway. They're using like an 80 millimeter fan, I think, and can get pretty loud under load.
Well, here we go. One of the comments, why full ATX? PCI cards needed, 2 GPUs, 1 SDI capture card, plus 10 gigabit Ethernet and Thunderbolt 3. Haven't found a motherboard yet with both onboard 10 gig and Thunderbolt 3, so that probably means a fourth slot. I don't know. It's always funny when people are like, nobody needs a small motherboard. Darn it.
Nobody needs more than mini ITX.
Yes, they do. Okay.
I know they do. Unless they like expansion cards beyond one slot.
There's a case right next to me with 3 HDMI capture cards inside of it, which is definitely not going to fit in most mini ITX cases. Maybe not all of them.
All right. In that instance, you are allowed micro ATX. That is the official small form factor stance of this week in computer hardware.
There are several micro ATX motherboards available if you search a lot.
It's the forgotten form factor, and it makes me sad. A few years ago, I was like, you know, why would anybody need more than this? You've got like 3 or 4 expansion slots. You can put like the power delivery on them is excellent, especially the higher end ones. You can overclock with them and put it in a nice compact case. But when you think 9x6 versus 9x6x12, it's really not that big of a difference. And maybe ATX is just fine too.
Yep. Oh my goodness. If you have a MacBook Pro that was sold between a 15-inch MacBook Pro sold between September 2015 and February 2017, you may have some battery issues, says Apple, and they have a voluntary recall and replacement program, again, for 15-inch MacBook Pros. Some of them, a select group of them, sold between September 2015 and 2017. The battery may overheat and pose a safety risk. I will let you use your imagination to figure out what that safety risk might be. You can identify them by their product serial number, and the recall does not affect, quote, any other 15-inch MacBook Pro units or other Mac notebooks, according to Apple. So if you go to About This Mac in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, and if you have MacBook Pro Retina 15-inch mid-2015, you can enter your computer's serial number on the program page to see if it is eligible for a battery replacement. And it's basically support.apple.com/15-inch-macbook-pro-battery-recall. And we just wanted people to know that was out there. We don't know how many units are affected. Traditionally, it has been under, you know, traditionally the company is always like perhaps one or two, a few, a handful. And then, you know, as soon as they start pointing this out, people start, you know, sending pictures of their exploding Samsung Note 8s, but on the internet, on YouTube. But in any case, you know, go check it out if you have a MacBook Pro, just in case, because it would suck for your battery to light your lap on fire. There, I said it. Nobody wants a flaming lap. Not me, anyhow. I'm going to directly quote John Porter over at The Verge. Signify, the company formerly known as Philips Lighting that produces Hue-branded smart lights, has announced a new range of internet-transmitting Li-Fi lights called True Li-Fi. They're capable of transmitting data to devices like laptops at speed up to 150 megabits per second using light waves rather than the radio signals used by 4G or Wi-Fi. And the really cool thing about using light waves instead of Wi-Fi or 4G or 5G or any other RF frequency is that, generally speaking, you don't have to worry about having interference from your neighbor's light bulbs as long as there's a wall between you and your neighbor's house. See, walls are spectacular at blocking light, unlike routers, unlike 802.11ac and gb, excuse me, Wi-Fi 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1 routers. So so Signify is actually going after, quote, professional markets like office buildings and hospitals rather than homes, where it has the potential to reach a much wider audience, writes Mr. Porter. So, and it was interesting. It's been around for a while, The Verge even got to try a Li-Fi prototype back at CES 2018. So, in no small part because just about everything on the planet would require an external adapter to connect to a Li-Fi network. Much like the early days of Wi-Fi on laptops, when you needed an external Wi-Fi adapter. So, it's interesting. And, yeah, the choice of hospitals is pretty obvious because RF can be a wicked ripping pain when you're trying to make people make sure people don't have issues with like dying because machines don't operate properly with all the RF around them. I just like saying Li-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, internet by light.
It's better than Wi-Di. You remember the wireless display tech? Yeah. Don't call it that. Don't call it that. But it was Wi-Di. That's not good. That's negative.
You know, sometimes.
It sounds like life. It's perfect for hospitals. You're onto something with this, Patrick. Life.
I want to live. Fi data. Yeah, that's a sign. It's probably time to end the show. You. you probably can or cannot. This is a binary option here. Can you or can you not tell us what card you are benchmarking behind you?
Oh, this is all stuff that's been out. Okay. It's all like this system has a Radeon 7 2700X in it.
Okay.
This is a RTX 2080. And this system has an i7 8700K in it currently, although I'm about to switch it out to a 9700K. So I'm just redoing old CPU benchmarks. I wasn't able to reuse any of the old stuff because it's all old builds of Windows, old driver versions. A lot of stuff has changed.
New baseline.
Yeah. So as many games as I can force myself to benchmark, I will benchmark. I'm doing like 5 different CPU tests, just like raw CPU compute power, single and multi-threaded, and then as many games as I can do. But I mean, there's only so much time between now and when new Ryzen processors go on sale. And this is the part of the job that is the least glamorous imaginable.
I mean, having the basic information to be able to compare new processors to existing ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I'm looking at, like, like trying to click through the AMD website. Like, is there anywhere I can sign up to pre-order?
Not that I've seen. I know they did that in the past, but we have not seen anything like that yet.
We wait with bated breath, ladies and gentlemen. We got a new episode of AVXL on the hopper. This will be coming out if you want to head over to AVXL.com. And I'm working on some other stuff, which I'll tell you about in the none too distant future. But right now, we are mostly super excited about the world's first PCI Express 4.0 ready desktop PC platform with the broadest ecosystem readiness in AMD history, planned for July 2019. I love reading press releases. It makes me so happy.
You know what will not make you happy? It will be almost a full month before we're back here again talking about those. Because I'm looking at the calendar. Well, 3 weeks. 3 weeks! Because 2 weeks from now is only the, well, that's the fourth. But the week after that, we'll be back, I assume, talking about new Ryzen 7 and 9 and 5 or whatever we end up getting to test. We'll test them. We'll compare them to the results we're getting here, and then we'll talk about it. And there's leaks out there. You can search the web, and there's like Geekbench screenshots and things to give you an idea. But we're not really going to know how it does in gaming until we actually test it. So
you're hurting my heart, man.
I know. Three more weeks, Patrick. I'm sorry.
So close. So close. And yet so far. With that, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to It's on the Horizon.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, wait. There is a Notify Me box now on the AMD Ryzen 9 desktop processor webpage.
Okay.
Sign up to be notified when products are available. Well, I'll do that after the show. You've been listening to
Patrick, 7-7. Remember, it's all about sevens. I'm pretty sure they're available. But
my problem is I want to pre-order as soon as I can pre-order.
I think AMD would approve of that stance. Like, yes, everyone pre-order. Forget about the reviews. Forget about it. Just buy it now. Just shut up and buy it.
Shut up and buy it. Damn it. Welcome to this
week in computer hardware,
where our motto is shut up and buy it. Don't listen to us.
I remember a certain RTX graphics card review that was like, just buy it. That didn't work very well.
No, but, you know, the sting goes away sometime between now and death, if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe after a lot of therapy. Really, this is This Week in Computer Hardware. Twit.tv/Twitch is the place to find all of the information on how to subscribe to the audio or the video, or to get more information about us. And, of course, you can go to twit.tv to find all of the other wonderful Twit programming. If you're looking for more Sebastian Peak, and I can't see why you wouldn't, you should head over to pcper.com. I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me over at avxl.com. And we like to talk about well, not just hardware and software, but screens and speakers and surround sound over at AVXL. We've been kind of on a low-speed release of shows over there. We're sort of ramping things up again. That'll be exciting as we do that. Right now, though, we want to thank you for listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, because, quite frankly, without you, there's no point in making this show each and every week. So, hey, thank you for listening. Tweet at Sebastian Peak or at Patrick Norton if you've got questions about hardware. We'll be keeping an eye on the Twitter. And in the meantime, thank you so much. I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peak.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.